Hi, this is Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy, and I'm really excited to have Bob Puglisi with me, another Corona boy. And he's a noted author, and he's been in the movies, and he's done lots of things in his career. So welcome, Bob. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's lots of fun.
Yeah, definitely. So I want to talk about, you know, some of your career and your website, but before we do that, I want to ask you about, you know, your Italian upbringing and where your parents are from.
Yeah. Both of my parents were born here, but my, you know, grandparents came over when they were, some of them were, I guess, teenagers. My mother's side of the family, I'm pretty sure they always said they came from Naples, but where they, what I found out later, just recently, in the last 20 years probably, they were from Avellino, because we have an Air Force base there. And then when the war was going on in Bosnia, I heard about Avellino, our planes were going over there and bombing them. So that's where they were from. My father's side of the family were Sicilian. And my grandfather came from Messina, and my grandmother came from Catania. And we went to Taormina a long time ago, about, 30 years ago or something. And we tried to find some relatives in Catania. But the day we went to go to Catania, the trains are on strike. That's, you know, so typical of Italy. And so and we were leaving the next day to go back to Rome and then fly home. So I never got there. We did, my aunt gave me an address of some relatives in Rome, and we went there, and it was August, you know, when most of the Italians go on vacation.
Right, that's right.
Yeah. So we couldn't even get into the place. It was a bell outside, and we rang the bell, and nobody responded. So we left kind of a cryptic half English, half Italian note for them that said where we were staying and phone number, but I never heard from them. So I think, you know, pretty much we lost track of the relatives that were over there.
Yeah, and you know, I never knew I had any from my father's family. My dad's from Naples, and my mom's from Taranto in Bari. But yeah, I you know, I didn't know until just recently. And my dad's mom, her family goes way back, and my ninth great grandfather and his son and a couple others, he was the Prince of Avellino. They owned almost all of what is Campania today.
Oh wow.
So my wife keeps asking me, where happened to everything?
yeah, we're royalty.
I said, I don't know. I said, I think it got watered down over the centuries.
And then my father's family, he grew up in Harlem, and then eventually, I don't know when, but sometime they moved to Corona. And then it's interesting, and then my mother's family grew up in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. And they wound up in Corona, living actually across the street from my father's family. And I think that was after my parents were married.
Oh, wow. Yeah, you know, see, now it's interesting that you bring up Harlem, because I never realized, and I should have, I never realized the Italian presence in Harlem until I just started watching The Godfather of Harlem. And I had no idea that, you know, the chin was up there, you know, and the large Italian presence in Harlem.
Yeah.
Up until, well, really not that long ago.
Yeah. Well, when I was a kid, my mother's family then moved to Staten Island. So we lived in Staten Island when I was, like, you know, born, and then up till I was about 5 years old. And then we moved to Corona because my grandparents on my father's side owned the candy store on 37th Avenue, about a block off the Junction Boulevard. And so we took over, and my grandfather had passed away, and my grandmother, she was alone. So my father and my mother moved. We lived in back of the store, and we ran the candy store. My mother hated it. My father continued to work, and he was a machinist, so he continued to work in the factory. And then eventually, I guess my grandmother sold the store, and she had the store. They lived on 101st Street, just below 37th Avenue. And so she owned that house, and my mother, my aunt lived downstairs where my grandmother had a room, and then my other uncle and aunt lived upstairs. And then we moved into my grandmother's other house where my other uncle and aunt lived. They lived downstairs, and we moved upstairs, and I was on 44th Avenue and 108th Street. And that's pretty much where I grew up until I guess it was around 1963 or 64. My parents bought a house in Staten Island and moved to Staten Island. It was right around just before the bridge opened. And my father worked in Brooklyn and Greenpoint, so it was, you know, he used to commute in from there. And then I got drafted and went in the Army, and my life, you know, my life kind of changed after that. And Corona was a thing of the past.
Yeah, but it's, you never lose Corona.
No, it's such a great town. It was a great place to grow up, you know, and I, in the last, in the 90s, well, actually in the 80s, we found Crested Butte, Colorado, and we started going there to ski, and then we started going out in the summertime. We bought a condo and then eventually a house, and we lived there until we moved here to Santa Fe. We were there almost 20 years, and it was a small town. It felt like being back in Corona again. You know, you knew everybody. Everybody knew you.
Yeah, and that's the way, you know, I grew up in College Point. You know, my parents grew up in Corona, but, you know, then they lived in Whitestone, and then we were in College Point. And College Point was the same way. I mean, you wouldn't even think it was part of New York City back in the 50s and 60s. And same thing, you know, everybody knew everybody and all of that. But Corona was special because, you know, everybody was Italian.
Right.
I don't know how that happened, but, you know, you walk down the street and there was the bakery and the Latticini place and, you know,
candy store.
Although there was Needleman's by the church they weren't Italian. Ruby's wasn't Italian, but you know, almost everybody else was, and the little ladies in black and and so, you know, that's why, you know, when I was reading Railway Avenue, it was just brought back a flood of memories, you know?
Yeah.
And like we said earlier, even though, you know, some of the names were changed to protect the innocent, I guess, I knew exactly what you were talking about and, you know, and that kind of thing. So what brought you to think to write that book about, you know, Corona? And it's great because it's a fiction book, but it really gives you a perspective of what Corona was, especially Railway Avenue, and for anybody who's listening from Corona who knows it.
Yeah. Well, I always wanted to write about Corona. I liked writing. It was always the thing that I did best in school, in English. I was always able to write, you know, pretty nice compositions and things. So I had always wanted to write about Corona, and I was going to NYU at night, and I had a English composition class, and we had to write something every week. Well, my mother called me, I don't know, like a Friday night, and my class was on Monday. I used to usually do my homework on the weekends. And she told me about a friend of ours who lived on 44th Avenue, who was murdered by her estranged husband. And, that's what I used in the book. But, you know, she was always the one that found the wounded bird every spring and helped it to heal, pale, and get flying again. And she's just the sweetest person. And apparently he was very abusive, and they got separated. And he came to this coffee shop she was at, where she used to go before she'd go pick up her kid at the nursing home, preschool. And he said, I can't live without you. I want you back. And she said, I just can't do this anymore. And he took a gun out and shot her and killed her.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what year was that?
Probably, let's see, maybe around 69.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, I was devastated. I couldn't write anything. And then finally, I think it was Sunday night, I finally decided, I said, I'm going to sit down and write about Vicky. And that was the beginning of the book. You know, and I struggled writing it for years and years. I tell people like it took me 30 years to write it, but I wasn't working on it all the time. I did a lot of other things. I wrote screenplays. I wrote some theater plays. It wasn't until I decided to make it a love story that it came together for me. And I was in a writing group in Colorado. People in the group really helped me. It was mostly women. It was me and one other guy. And so it's got a, you know, women are the people who buy books and read today. So I think they really related to it. It helped me kind of focus. And I finally finished it. And I think it was in 2013 was when I finally finished it. And plus the self-publishing came along, which made it a lot easier to get the book out there. So the first version of it, I said, a guy, a writer friend of mine, an author, he had worked with Clive Cussler and started publishing his own books. And he said, just make a Kindle book. And so I tried to get an agent and tried to find some publishers. And you know, I just collected a whole bunch of more rejection letters. So that's what I did. It came out as a Kindle book. And then when I went to, you know, usually you do readings and things. And I actually worked in the library too, so that helped. And I had nothing to sign. So I made up these cards. I do them for all my books now. And so this was my last.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, so I have them for Railway Avenue and Almost a Wise Guy. So whenever I had a reading, we would say, Bob Pugliese is going to be here, but he has nothing to sign. So at least I was able to give people a card. So after about 6 months, the book was doing pretty well as a Kindle book. I said, gee, I waited 30 years to write a book. I might as well get something I could put on my bookshelf. And so then I did the print book.
Oh, cool.
That's how it came about. And, you know, I was living in, like I was saying, this place, Crested Butte, was a lot like Corona. And my friends and people there were so supportive of creative people. That inspired me to keep going. And so now I write all the time.
That's great. Well, I'm trying to put together my book. I'm the furthest thing from a writer, so I have somebody helping me. But it's kind of a mix of, you know, my ancestry research and what I found and coupled with family stories, you know, yeah, from the backyard that you see behind me and things like that. And then a little bit of history about some of the, you know, very, very distant relatives that I have found, which are, you know, some very interesting stories about, you know, these Italian nobles that I never knew about. And, you know, for example, one family, there were like five generations and they were all the executioner. So it was like was this the family trade or, you know, and they weren't the guy who actually, you know, did the execution, but they were like I guess the head justice. I guess they signed off, you know, when the king set off with their head, this was the guy who signed off to, you know, do that, you know.
So when was this, what period of time?
Well, I've been able to go back to, I've been able to trace direct back to like Charlemagne and Rollo and those people through my paternal grandmother's mother, who I had never known. I never even heard of this woman until I started doing my research. Yeah. And you know, a lot of them are historical figures, you know, that you could read about. But many of them, especially the Italian ones, you would never know about these people. You know, you would never know that they owned 12 fiefdoms, or, you know, that one gave that one guy a town for the dowry for marrying his woman. You know, you got a town. You know, so it's you know, it's been a real adventure, and I don't know if I'll bore everybody to death with it, but to me, it's interesting. Because I was a big history fan, to find out about these people who, in their day, were prominent, very prominent in Italy, but you never would have heard of them.
Right.
And some you would, like, you know, I'm a direct descendant from Ferrante, the king of Naples, who, if you, I don't know if you saw the Borgias or not, but he,
Some of it.
So he was the guy who he kept his enemies very close. Mm-hmm. He had them stuffed and sat around the dining table like the Last Supper.
Nice guy.
And I'm also, and also in the Borgias is Alessandro Farnese, mm-hmm. whose his sister was the girlfriend, common law wife, whatever you want to call her, to the Pope, the Borgia Pope Alexander. Right. Alessandro, a cardinal, and he later became Pope.
Right.
But he had kids, you know. A lot of those guys had kids back then. So, you know, so like I said, I'm trying to put together something about that. But you mentioned I guess it was a book. I didn't go through all of yours yet. Was it the one about the wise guy? Almost the wise guy?
Yeah.
So for the people who don't know what a wise guy is, maybe you could give us a definition.
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com.
Let's see. Well, he's associated with the mob, mafia. And Vince was my first friend when I moved to L.A. I met him down at the pool. We lived in an apartment complex and had a swimming pool. And we lived on the top floor. He was on the second floor, I think. But I met him at the pool, and we became pretty good friends. He cut hair. He's a hairstylist. And so I had just moved to L.A. and I needed somebody to cut my hair. So he started cutting in my hair and became good friends. There was always something about him that I didn't, you know, he said, oh, Bobby, I had this life, you know, and blah, blah, blah. But he never went in, never elaborated on it. And I made a short film called My Bonneville, based on a screenplay that I won an award from the Colorado Council on the Arts from. And when we had a screening in L.A. in one of the studios for the movie, this is just a 25 minute short. And so we went out to dinner afterwards, and Vince was there with his daughter. And I had been asking him for years. I said, let's sit down and write your life story. And I always had the title, Almost a Wise Guy. Because he really wasn't a wise guy, but he was with those guys, you know,
Going
around with them, and, you know, so-and-so knew so-and-so. And so it wasn't until then that he, you know, finally said, okay, yeah, let's do it. And so him and his daughter came out to Colorado for a week, and we'd go fishing during the day and come home at night, and we'd make these nice Italian dinners. So then we'd go out on my front porch, and Vince is a cigar smoker, so we'd smoke some nice cigars, and I interviewed him and had a bunch of tapes. It took me a long time to transcribe the tapes into the book. And then I finally finished it, and we published the book, and it became real popular. Vince still lives in L.A. He still cuts hair. He's just turned 80 years old a few weeks ago. And he had a lot of his clients were in the movie business. So he wanted to right away, you know, see if we could get a movie made. And so that was back in, I don't know, 20... Right after Railway Avenue, that book came out. So it had to be about 2014, I think. And they've gotten, I didn't want to be any part of the Hollywood thing. So I said, no, I don't want to work on this. They got some other guy to write a screenplay. Actually, what they've been trying to do is put on a TV series about Vince's life. And he had an incredible life. The book is really chilling. I mean, he should have been dead many times or in jail. And that's how that book came about.
Yeah.
It's a great story. And, you know, so after he did all these terrible things, he was always cutting hair. When his daughter was born, he decided he really wanted to change his life. He was also an alcoholic and a drug addict. And, he decided to get into AA, and eventually he got sober, and he's been sober ever since, like 30-something years, and he's helped a lot of other people to change their lives too. So it's a nice, character arc in his story.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, like I told you, my dad was a photographer for the Daily News, so he took several photos of various hits and things like that. And but
Joey Gallo?
The Joey Gallo. He used to take Joey Gallo's photo all the time.
Yeah.
They were like I wouldn't say buddies, but Joey Gallo was, he liked to be in the papers, He liked his picture in the papers. But I noticed you have Marilyn behind you. So I'll tell you a Marilyn story, and then you can tell me yours.
I got some Marilyn stories too.
My uncle Phil, my dad's cousin's husband, he also worked for the papers. He was also a photographer, later a photo editor for the Daily News. But when he was very, very young, he took Marilyn's photo. Uh-huh. And that was the only picture he carried in his wallet for 60 years.
Wow.
Was his picture with Marilyn.
Yeah, I got a few of them back here, and then a bunch of them on this wall, too, smaller ones. One of the reasons I loved her. She was a wonderful, beautiful woman. We share the same birthday, June 1st.
Oh, okay.
But she was a lot older than me, of course. Actually a friend of mine gave me the one over there recently, and gave me some other one that she was in an advertisement for some kind of makeup, and it's this faded kind of metal thing. So whenever he finds this, and I just sent him, I bought a wall switch with her, the mm-hmm. you put on your, and,
yeah.
But it's the old fashioned kind, and I have the big wide ones now, for old people. So it didn't work. So I sent it to my friend. He said, yeah. He said, the switch is right over her right breast. My friend had a great story. He grew up in Hollywood, and we have a connection through somebody that was a mentor of mine when I started writing screenplays. David's uncle worked at 20th Century Fox, and he was the head of the camera department. He's won some awards for innovations that he did and things like that. So he was telling me, he's told me once, he said, yeah, he said, I had lunch with Marilyn Monroe at the commissary at the 20th Century Fox. So I never went further, but recently I'm writing this book about our experiences in Hollywood. And so I asked him, so what did you talk about when you were with Marilyn Monroe? He said, she came with his aunt, and they met at the commissary, and she was crying the whole time. The whole time they were there, because she had just broken up with Arthur Miller, and she was just so distraught. So there was no conversation. It was just Marilyn crying for, I don't know, half hour or something. And that was his story about Marilyn.
How'd you get started with this whole Hollywood thing and, doing screenplays and all of that kind of stuff?
Yeah. Well, I guess it was something I'd always wanted to do, when I was a kid. I remember when I was in Newtown in high school, I wanted to join the drama club, but I never did. It wasn't something that we did in the neighborhood. It
wasn't a manly thing back then.
No, it wasn't, when I became an actor, I always thought actors were, Jimmy Stewart, Cary Grant, and people like that, not guys for Corona. And so, let's see. So when I first moved to California, I lived in San Francisco, and then my wife, who's my girlfriend in New York at the time, she finally moved to LA, and so we'd kind of commute back and forth on the weekends. It was like $29 round trip to fly to LA, between LA and San Francisco, and then eventually I decided I really wanted to live in LA because the weather was warmer. But I was able to get a job in San Francisco because I worked at the Federal Reserve Bank in New York, and I just got a transfer to the bank in San Francisco. So I moved to LA, and everybody in LA is either a screenwriter, producer, an actor. And so I got the bug, and I decided I wanted to try acting, and went to a class. a film acting class, it was called, and it was by the guy who taught it, who was the founder of the school, was a guy named Tony Barr. And he was a tall, skinny guy. He looked like a mob guy. He said, you know, all he ever got were parts as mob guys or tough guys. And he wanted to teach actors to be more, you know, flexible, be able to do more different types of characters. And so he started the school. So I went to his classes, and I did that for a while, and I really liked it. And I got hooked into it. And you just get one thing after another, you know. Eventually got into the Screen Actors Guild, which is really the best way to start working. I got an agent, and I started doing extra work. I worked on one of Francis Coppola's movies. In fact, Gene Kelly was the choreographer for the movie. It was so cool it was so cool to see him. And he was just, he'd walk across the set, and it just looked like he glided across. You know? his feet were probably about 3 inches above the ground. So, you know, just one thing after another, and getting a little more and more involved. And that's how I got into it. I really wanted to write, and a friend encouraged me to start writing. I started working on Railway Avenue. It didn't even have a name at the time, a title. And then I realized how hard it was to write a novel. So I said, maybe screenplays are the answer. And so I started studying screenplay writing and wrote some screenplays. One of them, an agent I had sent over to Coppola's Zoetrope Studios. So somebody there read it, but it never went anywhere. And that's sort of how I got into it. You know, I was on Hill Street Blues. That was a big goal of mine, to get on Hill Street. And I worked in a couple of movies with Faye Dunaway. Mommy Dearest was one, the story about Joan Crawford's life. And then I did a movie. I first met her on a movie about Evita Perón. Mm-hmm. She played Evita.
Yeah.
And I had several scenes with her. And, you know, it's just extra work at first. And then eventually when I got into the Screen Actors Guild, I started getting, you know, I got on Hill Street Blues. I was in Matlock, a scene with Andy Griffith as a hot dog vendor.
you had experience with that coming from Corona, because he was right across the street.
And the scene was, he offers me some tickets to Gilbert and Sullivan play, and I go, where are they fighting? it's a musical. And so, you know, so yeah, it was fun. I just enjoyed it. I worked in the computer industry, so I, you know, I had a job. I didn't have to wait tables like most of my acting friends. And my wife Anita was involved. She worked for CBS in New York, and then worked for CBS in Hollywood. And she worked for Eric Severide's son, Michael Severide. And he was the CBS executive for All in the Family, MASH, all of those sitcoms that were real popular back then.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. Those big shows.
Yeah, and got promoted to doing Movies of the Week. And they moved from Television City in Hollywood over to Studio City, where the CBS had another big lot. And then eventually Anita became a Disney executive, and so I always claimed she had a better career than I did in Hollywood. That's a lot somewhere. I never could break out of the what they call day player roles, where you just went in for the day, and you had a couple of scenes, one scene, or maybe a few lines. To get from that to co-starring roles, couldn't make that jump. There's a story, a guy, I was doing extra work, and I used to study acting at Lee Strasberg's school, the Lee Strasberg Institute. And so there was a guy in my class, and I told him about extra work, and I gave him some contact information, a couple of, contact people I had worked with. And so the guy goes off, and I see him, week or two later, and he says, oh, thank you so much. I got this job. I went on this extra job. And he said, when I got there, I went up to the director, and I said, I'm so-and-so, and I'm here for the day. If you need me for anything, just call on me. Well, a little while later, they come over and go, you know, we need somebody to say a few lines in this movie. And would you like to do that? Yeah, of course. The guy gets his Screen Actors Guild card. And I was still trying to get into the guild. And you go, oh, here's this guy. I'd help him, and he gets his card. I didn't.
So to get the card, you have to have a certain amount of experience or something to get
well,
that?
Well, there's several ways you get it. You could either be, you get cast in a movie, and you could get it that way. Or you could get a letter from a producer or a director said, we're going to use Bob in a movie, so you know we'd like to get him in the guild, and then you get in that way. Or you join the, what's it called, AFTER, that was the television or radio guild. And that you could just go and you pay, I don't know, I think I paid $250 for initiation, and I was in the union. So then you could work like the soap operas, anything, most of the TV sitcoms, things like that. So I got in because I did, I was on General Hospital, a soap opera, and it was just an extra part. But I did get, I was on that. And then Archie Bunker, he had, after All in the Family, had another show called Archie's Place. And he owned
yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah. So he was really, he wanted to see actors get help, you know, get work. So I got called to be on his show and for a couple of times. And then they said, you get, now I've worked enough as in AFTRA, I could get into SAG. So I went down and I took my pay slips. I didn't even have a contract with these shows. They just got paid. And the lady who was in charge of, you know, membership came out to the lobby and I showed her what I had. She said, well, where's your contract? I said, well, I don't have a contract. That's all I have. So eventually she said, okay, well, we'll sign you up. And that's how I got in.
Oh, cool.
In fact, we had even had it was the Gong Show. You remember the Gong Show?
Yes. Yeah. I love that show.
Yeah. A lot of actors would go on the Gong Show and do some silly skit and you get the Screen Actors Guild card that way. And a friend of ours wanted to do that, but we never did it. So, but a lot of guys got in like that.
Well, this has been a lot of fun for sure. I love talking to people, you know, Italian people from Corona. So that's a special treat. So for anybody listening, especially people from Corona, where could they find your website and where can they get your books?
Well, my website is bobpuglisi.com, and I also do a monthly blog. So and my blogs are either Hollywood Tales, Random Thoughts, News, or I think those are the three categories. And and writing and self-publishing. And so yeah, so bobpuglisi.com is my website. All my books there are links on the website to all my books. You could send you to Amazon to buy them. You can get my books at bookstores. They mostly don't stock them, but they can order them for you.
Yeah, and for anybody who's listening from Corona, and I'm sure there'll be many, you have to at least get Railway Avenue because it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and the other one is Midnight Auto Supply, and that takes place during Vietnam and how these guys dealt with Vietnam, the draft hanging over their head, and they steal a car for some crazy reason. So I knew some guys who did that.
Yeah, I knew a few too.
You knew a few too.
All right. Well, thanks again, Bob. I appreciate
it. Thank you. It was so nice to talk to you.